listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, a lot in the news right now. The TPP fast-track bill is still working its way through Congress and still getting no coverage in the corporate media. Surprise, surprise. We'll get back to that. The NSA has told Senator Sanders, you know, we can't tell you if we're spying on you because it's classified. seriously. I'll give you more details on that in a little bit. And interestingly, and WikiLeaks just published the environmental chapter of the TPP, which it turns out is all voluntary. All these standards, corporations should be encouraged to follow voluntary guidelines. Right. This is really going to work. Meanwhile, the state of New Hampshire looks like the legislature there is poised to fully decriminalize, legalize, as in Colorado and Washington State, pot, marijuana. Although the governor of that state has said that she, a Democrat, has said that she will veto that if it is passed. This is very interesting. And Colorado seems to be, you know, starting to rake in some cash on this thing. Washington State hasn't yet figured out their regulatory scheme, but they're working on it. But it's a debate that is being engaged. In fact, the day before yesterday, here in Washington, D.C., the city council passed out of committee to the council as a whole a resolution to essentially decriminalize marijuana, at least possession of less than an ounce here in the district. Make it a $25 parking ticket, basically. No criminal record, no arrest kind of thing. So what's the story here? What direction is this country going? What's the arc of history? What are the politics of this? And what about the policy of this? Charles Cully Stimson, the manager of National Security Law Program and a senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation, is on the line with us. Heritage.org, of course, is their website. Cully, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me back again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. So tell me why you think that pot should not be decriminalized like they've done in Colorado, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, I come at this from the perspective of seeing people in drug treatment programs, in drug court as a criminal defense attorney and a prosecutor and as a judge. So I've been on all three sides of the courtroom, luckily not the defendant side yet. I've read the research, I read the studies. I just think, Tom, that some of the myths that are out there are just wrong based on my reading of the research, like the fact that people suggest that marijuana is harmless. I think the studies are rather clear that they're not harmless. There are negative social consequences, that marijuana is not addictive. I think there are a lot of studies that suggest and support the fact that it can be addictive.
At least have it for me. What percentage of Americans, though, compare pot to alcohol. Is alcohol not, we got 50,000 Americans a year who die just from, basically liver failure from alcohol.
Yeah, and a lot of us have had alcoholics in our families, me included, and it's a horrible, horrible condition.
Those people were pot addicts, they would not die of cirrhosis of the liver. Nobody has ever died from an overdose of marijuana. Nobody has ever died from chronic use of marijuana. I mean, ever, literally.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's even provable.
If you could name one person who's ever died from too much pot, I'll take it back.
Yeah.
Guessing if there was such a person, we'd all know his name.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I don't do politics on this. I do policy on it. Looking at the research here shows that, for example, the body is predisposed to being able to dispose of or excrete alcohol in a way that's much easier, for example, than a regular use of marijuana.
Well, it's much more rapid. Pot is fat soluble, so it stays in our body for up to a month. Alcohol is not fat soluble. Actually, it'll dissolve fat. It's the other way around.
Yeah.
But it is rapidly metabolized by the liver. Pot is more slowly metabolized. But that doesn't speak to toxicity. That speaks to persistence.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, the pot that we all watched on the silver screen in the Cheech and Chong movies, that in the 70s, the THC level, as you well know, is about, was about 1%, maybe slightly more. The pot today, as you also know, the THC level can be as high as 30%.
No, I didn't know that.
We're talking about
that's pretty astounding.
We're talking, you're getting more bang for your buck.
Right.
One, and the fact that the active ingredient THC in pot is so high today, from anywhere from 6% up to 30%, it really is a different type of.
But Scully, I can tell you as somebody who, I mean, you know, it's been a lot of years, and especially, you know, being in the public eye, you know, over the years, on a couple of occasions, I've socially imbibed, shall we say, before
sure.
I started doing a radio show.
Yeah.
But when I was a teenager, I smoked a lot of pot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, up until, I guess, probably around the time I was 20, 21, when I got married and we had a kid, and that
yeah.
was it. You know,
and why'd you stop?
Louise, well, we stopped because we had a child and I had a job and I was engaged in the economy and you know, it just didn't. I mean, there were actually years during my teenage years where I didn't smoke any also because I was really into meditation and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I went back and forth. But my point is that you smoke until you're high, and because you're inhaling it, you know, it hits you quite quickly.
Right.
And so you self-regulate your dose. And so
right.
it wouldn't matter if it's 1% or 30%. I mean, if it was 1%, you might smoke an entire joint. If it's 30%, you might just take half a toke.
Right.
I don't see why that's a problem. If anything, that's just an economic problem.
Yeah. Look, I am very drawn to some libertarian arguments. And, of course, the pot argument is squarely in the front and center of social dialogue right now. You know, shouldn't you be able to put something that's, quote-unquote, non-harmful into your body that doesn't have any negative social costs?
Or at least less harmful than alcohol.
Less harmful than alcohol. And I, number one, reject the fact that it's harmful, less harmful than alcohol, because certain alcohol, like wine, is shown to actually have helpful health
effects. Yeah, but you drink a bottle of wine and come driving over to my house,
right.
you know, the
right.
police will stop you on the way.
Yeah.
There's a reason
but
for
you,
that.
If you use alcohol, for example, in a responsible way, take a glass of wine, and you use marijuana the way it's intended to be used by smoking a joint,
right.
You know, the person who drinks the glass of wine is not going to have any negative effects on society, a glass of wine, whereas you smoke a joint today, as you just pointed out, with the 30%, the 15% THC level, and you're going to have a hard time cognitively being able to do what you should.
Well,
do
no, it's going to depend on how high you choose to get. Just like with alcohol, you can sit in a restaurant and drink 3-4 glasses of wine in a row, or just a half a glass. Or if you've got some pot, you can just take a very tiny toke and say, I just want to get a little bit of a buzz. Or you can just get, you know, wasted and say, you know, I intend to just sit here and fall asleep.
Yeah. Well, the premise of your comment, and you're a great radio host, is that people will be responsible.
Well, I think most people are. I think there is that 2 or 3% who are always going to be addicts and abusers
yeah.
with alcohol and pot. But at least with pot, they're not going to lose their livers.
Look, by legalizing pot, states like Colorado and others that have so-called medical marijuana, which it's not a medicine, and we can debate that if you want, they're sending a message not only to adults but to other people, young people in particular, that this is fine, it's okay to do, and
well, as a drug, that's why we want to regulate it, make it available to adults. You know, that adults can abuse drugs, adults can, you know, buy tobacco, which is an abusable drug, adults can buy alcohol, adults can buy pot.
Yeah, and if you look at the percentage of arrestees, there's a very high percentage of arrestees who are arrested for other crimes who are dependent or have tested positive for marijuana. And that's a problem.
Well,
it's a gateway drug to even harder drugs.
Well, that's a whole other issue, and I think that has to do with where you're getting it. Because if you're getting it from people who are selling other drugs, but anyway. Cully, we're out of time. Cully Stimson, heritage.org. Thank you,
Cully. Always great to chat with you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I appreciate it. Good talking with you too, Cully. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. And Nate is busily working on a brilliant intro for our TV show tonight. So he's not going to be with us to tell you all about what's coming up on the show tonight. Actually, I'll give you a quick rundown of what's coming up on the show tonight. We're going to start out with a debate with David Laska. I'm going to be suggesting it's time to start the WPA up again. You know, let's do the Works Progress Administration. Let's do the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Let's recreate some of these programs. The best welfare program is a job. So let's put people to work. Let's have the government be the employer of last resort. And then David Laska is going to come on. He's a director of communications for the Republican State Committee in the state of New York. And he's going to come on and tell me that I'm crazy, which should be an interesting conversation. In Block B, we're going to be talking with Liz Winstead about the Supreme Court and the abortion clinic buffer zone debate, and just in general, the war on women in the United States, the state of the war on women. And that should be a good one. Oh, and Jimmy LaSalvia, who I've had on the program a number of times. He's an out gay Republican who co-founded the group Go Proud, which was originally GOP Proud, right? G-O Proud, as in GOP, the gay Republicans. He has been so ostracized that he's just said, okay, screw it, I'm not a Republican anymore. I'm going to become an independent. And that, I'm looking forward to that conversation. I haven't talked to Jimmy. It's been probably a year since I've talked to Jimmy, and he's a good guy. So, and he's a true believer as a Republican. And so I think this is going to be, we're going to have an interesting evening. And then, you know, our daily take is going to be on the multiplier effect, which we will talk more about a little later on. So that's what's coming up tonight. Lynn in Los Angeles. Hey, Lynn, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to comment on our pot debate?
Yeah, excuse me, because I have laryngitis. But
that's okay. I hope it's not from smoking too much pot.
No, it's from a cold.
Okay.
But anyway, I've been an addiction doctor, and I've also an internal medicine doctor, and I've done a lot of research on the effects of different drugs, and I can tell you that marijuana is the least toxic drug that people use for recreational, you know, whatever, you know, recreational high and it also has a lot of excellent medical effects, particularly for people with anxiety, insomnia, nausea from cancer, just chronic pain and spasm from chronic back problems like spinal stenosis. And I've seen the devastation of alcohol. And I really, even though I don't think anybody should abuse drugs, when I see alcoholics, I wish that if they were going to be an addict, I would much prefer that they be a marijuana addict, because although there does have some negative effects on the lung, in general, there's just no comparison. It's like comparing a flea to an elephant.
And I think, you know, eventually, well, it's not even eventually. There's these vaporizers now, you know, and then you can make tea and you can make brownies. I mean, there's ways to mitigate those negative effects on the lungs. It's sort of like cigarettes. Now you can get these e-cigarettes that don't give you cancer. They just, you know, they just allow you to be a nicotine addict. I'm guessing pretty soon we're going to see the THC being extracted from pot, and we're going to have e-cigarettes with THC in them, you know, which would be very, very interesting. So, Lynn, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Thanks for calling. We'll be back. A federal judge yesterday in Oklahoma struck down that state's ban on gay marriage, by the way, although he also stayed his own order. So gays in Oklahoma can't get married, even though he struck down the constitutional ban on it, saying that the state constitution's ban is a violation of the federal constitution's 14th Amendment, which says that, you know, all persons have equal protections under the law. And, you know, of course, this has been badly abused by corporations. But, you know, if corporations can have equal protection, why can't gay people? Right. So anyhow, that's just a little FYI. At the same time, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals says that there's no constitutional right to buy booze in the stores that you buy food from. Somebody tried that in Kentucky, you know, tried taking that to court. Yeah, we'll see. So anyhow, I may have in that last segment disclosed more to Cully and my audience. Too much information, Tom. We don't know. We don't want to know how much pot you smoked when you were a kid. Or not. I don't know. I do have a strong opinion about this, and the reason why is because I'm familiar with this. And I'm also familiar with alcohol abuse and the abuse of other hard drugs, both through personal experience and friends of mine. And I can tell you that, there's some really nasty stuff out there. There's some stuff that'll really rack your brain up out there. And, I think that, I understand doing everything you can to keep things like that, some of these designer drugs and whatnot, out of the public sphere. But on the other hand, I think that anything that you can grow in your backyard should be legal. Just that simple. Right across the board. So anyhow, that's my take on it. And I think that alcohol is one of the most destructive of our drugs. And, there was a really, really strong case that was made successfully that alcohol was a destructive drug in the late 1920s or early 1930s. And it led to the prohibition of alcohol in the United States. And that didn't work out real well. Because people are, it's just the nature of animals to want to alter their consciousness. We've got a new kitten and we've got a fat old cat, Fang, I've got a chair, it's an office chair, it's just like the one I'm sitting in right now. It's one of those, there's a fancy name for them, but, they're these very comfortable office chairs with the kind of, netting underneath and on the back, and they're very popular in offices. And you can spin it around, right? And this cat on the boat, we've got a couch, and then there's the chair, and it's my old office chair, and it's sitting in the salon, the living room of the boat, which is also kind of the dining room and the kitchen, but you get it. And in front of the TV, and so if we're watching TV, Louise gets up. She likes to sit in that chair. I'll lay on the couch or sit on the couch. If she gets up and goes to get a glass of water or something, the cat immediately jumps on the chair, because then I'll reach over with my foot and I'll start spinning the chair around. And this cat just loves for me to spin the chair around to the point where he's just like totally stoned. And then he'll jump off the chair and he'll just stagger around for 3 or 4 minutes as he's getting his balance back. And then once he gets his balance back, he'll jump up on the chair again and say, "Spin me around again." Right? Elephants seek out fermented fruit. Birds seek out fermented fruit. It is, primates take psychedelic plants and get high. I mean, all this is very well documented. There is built into all of us a need, I would say, to alter our consciousness. And some of us fill that need by doing things like bungee jumping and skydiving. And having done the latter, in fact, I broke my back the third time I was skydiving. I can tell you, it alters your consciousness. Some of us alter our consciousness by other kinds of risk-taking behavior. Some people alter their consciousness, everybody, I suppose, does. Most people do with sex as a way of altering consciousness, altering states, shall we say. There's all these things that we do that just kind of pop us out of the average humdrum day-to-day normal state and into something else. Reading fiction, reading novels, going to the movies, watching TV. We do all these things to modify our baseline state. I am convinced that this is just a basic need, and that there's a certain percentage of the population, and I'm guessing it's actually... I was saying 3% will be chronic abusers, and I think it's probably closer to 1 or 2% of people who are just going to, no matter what it is, they just can't stop, and they're going to go nuts. But I think that probably more like 60, 70, 80% of us, maybe even 90, 95% of us, on a regular basis, try to alter our consciousness in smaller ways. Not being perpetually stoned. That's that 1 or 2 or 3 or maybe 4 or 5%, but I think it's probably more like 1%, because it would render you unable to work. And then you look at unemployment statistics and whatnot, but who knows? I don't know. I don't know the percentage of drug addicts in our population. I don't know the percentage of alcoholics, but whatever that percentage is, that's going to be with you no matter what. That's not going to go away just because you ban the substance. People are just going to go to something else. When alcohol was banned, people were drinking methanol and they were going blind. They were sniffing gasoline, and they were becoming mentally retarded. I mean, literally getting brain damage from it. So if we all have this wired need to occasionally alter our consciousness, and some percentage of us, whether it's 30% or 70%, are going to do that with a substance, be it a glass of wine or a toke, why not make it the least destructive drug we can come up with? And it seems like pot meets that criteria. And so that's my argument for decriminalization and regulation. I share Cully's concern. I don't want 10-year-olds smoking pot. I think this should be an adult activity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once, your life is organized and stable, and then you say, okay, it's Friday night, I want to kick back, or it's Saturday afternoon, then that makes a certain mindset. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'd like to, those of you, we've got a lot of callers on this topic that we started the hour with, and I'm going to get back to it in about 8 or 10 minutes. But just, hang with me here for a few minutes. We're doing a fundraiser and a general awareness thing, but also a fundraiser for the Hunter School. Just a brief 3-day mention, hunterschool.org. Yesterday, a mother of one of the children in Hunter School came on and told the story of her daughter who was, in her opinion, her life was saved from a very destructive system by the Hunter School. And what I didn't mention yesterday is that her daughter was in the program as a result of a scholarship program that we've set up that is entirely the consequence of donations that come into the program. And so the school district would not pay to place her child in the Hunter School. And so we said, okay, we've got the scholarship fund. We'll take you in for the first month, and then if there's good results, maybe we can convince the school district. And there was good results, and they did convince the school district, and so the child can stay in the program. And we're trying to expand that scholarship fund. And so just an FYI, go over to hunterschool.org, and you can make a donation. And in fact, over at hunterschool.org, with any donations over $100, there's some really cool little decorative tote bags. One will be sent to you. And Anna is with us. Anna is one of the students at the Hunter School. Hunterschool.org is the website. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, how long have you been at Hunter School, and what's your experience been like there?
I've been at the Hunter School for about a year and a month, and it's been really awesome. It's definitely helped me in so many ways. It's helped me overcome a lot of my issues that I've had. It's been one of the most life-changing experiences I've probably ever had.
That's wonderful. Now, I understand you write poetry. You decorate. You're decorating the tote bags that we're giving out with these donations. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I actually have a few little helpers. A lot of the kids here, we had some extras, and I needed some help with them, and I asked the kids to help me design them. So a lot of the kids made them, and they're really cute.
We have a budding entrepreneur here. Tell me about your poetry.
I write it when I'm upset or I just am stressed or I just feeling in the poetry mood.
Yeah, that's great. And I understand that you're in a play at Plymouth State University, at the university that's down the road from the Hunter School.
Oliver.
What's the play Oliver?
Oliver is about a little boy who is an orphan, and he gets captured, and he is sent to work and be like a slave or a pit pocket, and he runs into this man who's his like grandfather, and then they sing a bunch of songs. Hard to explain.
It sounds like a variation on a Dickens story. Do you know if it is?
I think it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's Oliver Twist.
Oliver
it's
Twist, right.
Oliver.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So I understand you're also involved with the permaculture program at Hunter School. Can you explain what permaculture is?
Permaculture is like gardening, things to do with the environment. It's pretty much getting your hands dirty and enjoying the nature around you.
Mm-hmm. And doing so in a way that is sustainable and not chemical?
Yeah, it's all organic. We recently got a greenhouse. We have two now, and we're growing our own food, and we have garlic beds and apple trees out in the orchard.
That's great. That is absolutely great. And finally, how do you feel about decorating some of these tote bags for the scholarship program? Is that okay?
I absolutely think it's a great idea. I love thinking about that. My bags are helping people donate money to kids that cannot pay, right, or their parents can't pay for a kid to go here. And I just feel great that people want to donate so kids can go here. And that just, because I'd love to see other kids get the help that I got. And I think that it's just great that I get to do this. It was quite an honor.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Anna, for the talent and the skill pardon? Uh-huh. For you're bringing to this, and just to restate for everybody, we're doing a fundraiser for the Hunter School for our scholarship program, and for every $100 or more contribution that you make over at the website at hunterschool.org, we'll send you one of the, or Hunter School will send you one. And there's no big fundraising apparatus. This is all, volunteer work being done by the teachers and the staff. And, there's no, this is, and the kids now. So every penny that comes in is going to go to some child's scholarship, literally every penny. So at hunterschool.org. Anna, do you have a poem you'd like to read for us?
Yes, I do. I've actually created one about Hunter School.
Okay, great. Go for it.
H is for Hunter, the school with light. U is for the unique children that come and go, day and night. N is for nice, because you will always be treated with a smile. T is for trust, that we all share, once in a while. E is for extraordinary views that go as far as the eye can see. R is for the right school that helped you and me.
That is great. That's awesome. You're brilliant.
Thank you.
So, Anna, thank you. So is there anything you'd like to add? Anything else you'd like to share?
I guess what everyone do. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
Okay. That's great. And thank you for this award. Anna, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a big pleasure.
Thanks. You are absolutely wonderful. And I so much appreciate your coming on and participating with us. And once again, if any contribution over $100 given over at hunterschool.org, Anna and her friends made 100 of these tote bags, and we sent out a newsletter a few weeks ago, and 40 of them went out, and Anna's really enthusiastic to get the other 60, on the road, as it were. So the Hunter School is just a wonderful, wonderful program for kids on the autistic spectrum and kids who with ADHD or who are just having some real challenges in their lives and who are really special kids. I mean, we take the perspective, Hunter's School takes the perspective that these are not broken children who need to be fixed, that they're exceptional individuals and in many cases incredibly talented, brilliantly exceptional individuals who need to learn how to bring their gifts out. And, let's help them bring out their gifts. So it's a great program. So check it out, hunterschool.org. So that said, let's get back to the topics that we were talking about. Paul in Lucerne, California, you want to get back to pot, which seems like an odd segue from kids. But actually it's not because, we're saying, this should be an adult activity. Recreational. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Paul.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. That guy was talking about pot being a gateway drug. Alcohol is the biggest gateway drug out there, for one.
Yeah, I agree.
And he's talking about pot being more potent. Well, yeah, it is a lot more potent, and very few strains go up in the 30% range, too. That's very rare.
Yeah, that would.
So it's around 10 to 12%.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well,
okay.
I used to be in this business. I used to do this for a living, so I do know a little bit about it.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of studies shown right now that the medical marijuana has so much medicinal value, that's not even funny. In fact, when they outlawed marijuana during Prohibition, the Surgeon General at the time wrote a lengthy op-ed and published it in the New York Times and a bunch of other papers about that's the wrong thing to do. This plant has so many medicinal qualities that you can't even count them all.
Really?
So, I mean, it's kind of, I don't really like when people go up there and they tell these big fat lies and they act like it's no big deal. If marijuana was the recreational drug of choice of the United States, Super Bowl Sunday would no longer be the most violent domestic violence day of the year. Okay?
Is it? Really? Is Super Bowl Sunday the number one day for domestic violence in the United States?
Yes, it is.
Wow, because people are drinking alcohol and watching football on TV.
Yeah.
And then they go beat up their spouses. Or their kids. That's incredible.
And their team lost. They wouldn't be beating up their loved ones.
Yeah, I think you're right. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thomas in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to AM 1350. We have a minute to the break, Thomas.
I have you on speaker. I was just calling about the medical marijuana as well, and my comment was basically along the same lines. I suffered from pretty much a life-altering brain injury about 6.5 years ago, and let me catch my breath here. Basically, for me, it saved me from having to be on prescriptions. I was on hydrocodone.
Well, which is a strong painkiller. It's an opiate.
Exactly. Lots and lots of strong painkillers. What I have, because of my brain injury, are mood changes, really drastic mood swings that come out of nowhere. And right. So for me, instead of having to take, two pills every day for the rest of my life, I'm able to just take a couple hits of pot, just like you were saying, just enough to bring me back from being really, really, on the edge of, oh, my God, freaking out. And that's all process of my brain injury.
Yeah. Well, and I think, one of the things that pot is used for is anxiety disorders. And so, even for people who don't have brain injuries. Very interesting. Thomas, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. It is 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what should the Democratic governor of New Hampshire do if her legislature decriminalizes pot? She says she's going to veto it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And is it Tara or Tara in Hopland, California?
Hey, Tom, it's Tara. Thanks for asking.
Hi, Tara. How are you? What's up?
Okay, well, it's about the medical marijuana. I hate when you have authorities speaking like if they know what they're talking about when they're totally ignorant. A couple of things. We have to remember why marijuana was illegalized in the first place was DuPont pressured Congress to make it illegal because they wanted to sell nylon ropes to the Army in World War II. So that was the reason why this whole campaign was originally
put out. Well, wait a minute. It was made
put out.
Hemp was made illegal 2 decades before World War II. Was it maybe World War I?
1939, I think. Maybe it was 1932.
Oh, I thought it was the 19-teens. I frankly don't know. I'm sorry.
I'm pretty sure it's 1939, and it was definitely to do with trying to get nylon to be the substance of choice rather than hemp for ropes, basically, for the Army. But also the no healing properties, it's called medical marijuana for a reason. I have met so many people that were just in the hospital, couldn't eat at all, and then their friend gave them not smoking, but eating some candies, and they got their appetite back and eventually were released from the hospital, and now they're functioning again.
And
so
the candies had pot dissolved in them, presumably.
Right. But I understand there were so many things that guy said that you couldn't call him on every single issue.
Well, I think there's also the old adage of, give a person enough rope and they'll eventually hang themselves. it's just he was.
And you also, The gateway drug thing, you tried to get a word in edgewise there, but
yeah.
My opinion is the only reason that it's a gateway drug is because people that sell marijuana on the black market might also have other things in stock.
Right.
Because they're
operating in the black market.
Right. However, in 50 years of being a pot smoker, I have never once encountered a pot dealer selling another drug. So, maybe in the ghetto and places like that, it's common. But
yeah, you're off
the black market.
Yeah, you're in a small town.
You're
in a small town in California, yes. Though. That's very different than somebody in downtown LA, right?
Right, but if you take it off the black market, then they won't encounter those other drugs when they go to a pot club.
Right. Is it true that medical marijuana is so easily and readily prescribed in California that it's functionally legal now? Pretty much anybody can get a prescription and does.
Oh, I don't want to have to answer that.
Okay. Well, I would think that's a good thing, Frank, personally. There's some modest amount of regulation, but, that way it's...
Well, you do have to have a doctor's note before you go to the doctor that gives you the prescription for the medical marijuana. You do have to, have some kind of condition that you can prove to the doctor that prescribes.
Right, but it could be even, I have insomnia or I have a backache and
yes.
Yeah.
It can.
So, yeah. Okay.
It can.
Well, I'm just really okay with that. I think, in fact, I'm in favor of decriminalization altogether. But I think that's, a good step short of it. Tara, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Back 10 minutes before the hour. Sean in Blanchester, Ohio. Hey, Sean, you wanted to talk about pot?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of debunk some of the stuff that guy was talking about. I have severe spinal problems from a fall that I took off of a roof, and I'm on here in Ohio. Of course, it's not allowed, but I have what they call breakout pain. I mean, I'm on OxyContin morning and night, and I have an implant that runs up my spine, and even that's not enough to take care of what they call breakout pain. And they want to give me, more, what is it? The other pills for the breakout pain, and I refuse to take any more pills. I've been trying to get off of what I'm on now, but it's not working. And when I do take a hit, it's hard to even go in to describe what the pain is, but it's all through my back, and for some reason, I'll take a hit at night, and it just relieves the this unbelievable, it feels like somebody is just pulling everything towards the center of my back. I don't can't explain it. But
I've had people describe who are using pot for pain describe the experience as it causes me to feel like I'm not experiencing the pain, but I'm separate from the pain. Like the pain becomes it's not quite as close to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's the best way I've ever heard it described, because I've always said I don't even know whether or not it's taking care of the pain, but it helps me forget about it.
Right. It creates a dissociation of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, the pain is my life. I mean, morning, noon, and night, every second of the day.
Wow.
People don't understand and then these people that talk this stuff that have no clue as to what they're talking about to begin with. And yes, I grew up in the 70s, and I played all the games. That was over by the time I hit 20. But I kept on smoking pot. And then as I got older and got a steady job and, a good job, and I quit. Well, I lost my job because of this problem after 25 years.
Because of the pain.
And I loved my work. I mean, anyhow.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you that that guy didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, people need to hear your, you know, stories like yours more often. Sean, thank you for calling and sharing your testimony. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching us there in Blanchester, Ohio. Christy in Indian Wells, California. Hey, Christy.
Hi.
Hi. So you wanted to talk about marijuana also.
Yes, I wanted to give a few facts.
Mm-hmm.
In 1937, April 14, 1937, the marijuana tax law was enacted. And I'm just going to ramble off some facts, okay?
Sure.
Betsy Ross made the first Old Glory flag from hemp. The Declaration of Independence was penned on hemp.
In its first drafts.
90%, pardon? Yes.
In its first drafts. The final draft was done on vellum, on sheepskin.
That's correct. Sorry about that. Yes, the first draft. 90% of the U.S. ships, their sails and ropes were made from hemp and canvas. Comes from the Dutch word cannabis. Henry Ford made the bodywork of his first Model T from hemp, and it was his intention to have the biofuel from hemp operate his vehicles. And William Randolph Hearst, who owned an extensive amount of forestry, felt that hemp threatened his lumber profits. And he is the first one who started coining the word marijuana, the Mexican slang term for it, which disassociated it from the word hemp.
Huh.
And and he gets together with Andrew Mellon, who was President Hoover's Secretary of State,
right.
who was a principal shareholder in DuPont, who patented the production of plastics from oil and coal and the chemical use breakdown for wood pulp to paper. And since it's possible to make plastic from material and materials like such and paper from hemp, DuPont's patents become worthless. And so Mellon.
But why not? Hang on just a second, Christy. Why not just patent, instead of trying to make it illegal, why not patent the process to make plastics out of hemp? And why not, you know, patent it?
Well, get to that real quick.
Okay.
Why, that's the problem we're dealing with right now, the patent situation. Okay, so Mellon appoints Henry Anslinger, who's the son-in-law of...
Harry Anslinger. Yeah.
He's the son-in-law, okay, as... the bottom line is you can't patent the plant.
Uh-huh.
And that's...
But you can't patent a tree either, can you?
They're going to they're going to continue. You know what's funny is the American Medical Association was dumbfounded when they realized that marijuana was the they didn't realize that the term marijuana or the propaganda campaign was the same hemp derivative that they were prescribing to Americans over the early 20th century.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
How they got it through law? How they got it passed through law? They went to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Oh, as tax law.
Yeah.
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 And so it wasn't even debated.
Okay.
And it was the marijuana tax law, not the hemp.
Now, I remember the documentaries on Reefer Madness and stuff, and that there was a big element of racism in this whole thing as well. That's probably another piece of the history. But, Christy, we're out of time. Thanks a lot for the call. And, we'll continue as we go on through our program today. Coming up, isn't it time for the WPA, for the government to be the employer of last resort?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
You need to know this. Ronald Reagan and Franklin Roosevelt are often quoted as saying the best welfare program is a job, and they were right. That's why we need to do what FDR did in the 1930s. We need to create a new Works Progress Administration and make our government the employer of last resort. Right now, Republicans in the Senate are blocking every attempt to extend unemployment benefits. Yesterday, conservative opposition killed two separate bills to extend benefits, leaving approximately 1.3 million out-of-work Americans without a way to make ends meet for the third straight week. Republican refusal to extend unemployment insurance is nothing short of a crime. The economy just isn't good enough yet for people to reliably find work. And although the unemployment rate has now dipped down to 6.7%, the lowest it's been since President Obama took office, the amount or the number of people actually working and actively looking for work is shrinking. This is a scary number. Workforce participation is now at a 36-year low, 62.8%. And a lot of economists say that this is the main reason the unemployment rate has dropped, is because people have just given up. There's no jobs out there. So why bang your head against the wall? And the reason why is simple. The demand for jobs outpaces the supply. Well, actually, well, there's other reasons that are pretty simple, too. You know, we have an insane trade policy and an insane tax policy, which favor the wealthy over the middle class and ship our jobs overseas and cause us to buy products from overseas. And so we don't make things here anymore. According to the Economic Policy Institute, there are now three job seekers for every one job opening. And as a result of all of this, approximately 4 million people have been without a job for 27 weeks or longer, and the long-term unemployment rate is now the highest it's been at any time since World War II. We're back in the Great Depression. Thanks to Republican opposition to extending unemployment insurance, many long-term unemployed people will tonight have to worry about whether they will have enough money to pay their rent, heat their house, or even just find a way to get a job interview. Or to get to a job interview. This is just wrong. It's unacceptable that in the richest country in the history of the world, that anyone should have to worry about such basic needs as food and shelter, especially when you consider all the freebies that the government gives to big oil and big banks. But there are economic as well as moral reasons to extend unemployment insurance. Moody's Analytics estimates that every dollar spent on jobless benefits generates $1.55 in economic activity, and that refusing to extend benefits will cost our economy $39 billion in spending this year alone. Giving people money to spend when they wouldn't otherwise have money to spend generates economic activity that otherwise wouldn't exist. Unemployment insurance has what economists call a multiplier effect. Of course, despite all the evidence showing that giving out-of-work Americans money to spend is good for the economy, a lot of conservatives say, well, unemployment insurance creates a culture of laziness. Get a job, they scream. You can only get ahead by pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Right. Studies do show that people on unemployment insurance work harder to find a job than people who aren't on unemployment insurance. But there's something that works even better than unemployment insurance, and that's government directly putting people to work. If Republicans were actually serious about helping unemployed people get a job, as they put it, they'd do one simple thing: revive New Deal-era programs like FDR's Public Works Administration, Works Progress Administration, and the Civilian Conservation Corps. Back during the New Deal, unemployed people were put to work building bridges, roads, dams, and tunnels, you name it. The WPA alone was responsible for building 122,000 bridges, 572,000 miles of rural roads, 1,000 tunnels, and 19,700 miles of water mains. They built America. Thanks to programs like the WPA, the PWA, the CCC, the unemployment rate dropped from 25% when FDR took office to 9.6% by the time he was elected to a second term in 1936. Unemployment shot back up during the mini-recession of 37-38, but he quickly got it back on target. Not surprisingly, the surge in employment helped out the economy. GDP grew at a rate of 9% per year over FDR's first term, and grew as high as 11% per year later on in his presidency. GDP growth slowed during that mini-recession of 37-38, but like the unemployment rate, got back on track after the recession ended. By the way, many economists, including Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman, say that that mini-recession of 37-38 was caused by the government drawing back down on those successful New Deal programs, dialing them back, because back in the election of 36, there was all this sturm and drang about, you know, government borrowing and spending. So FDR said, okay, we'll slow it down a little bit. Well, yeah, didn't work so well. Of course, as many conservatives argue, the real thing that brought the U.S. out of the Great Depression was World War II. But what was World War II if not the biggest government spending program ever? Right now, our country is still mired in the aftershocks of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Although unemployment is nowhere near as high as it was right after Wall Street crashed the economy, that number is deceptive. Many people have just given up finding a job because there aren't jobs out there. And without unemployment insurance, millions of people are now living on the edge of total poverty. Congress needs to extend unemployment insurance, but it should go even farther than that and listen to what FDR and Reagan said about welfare. The best welfare program actually is a job. And that's why Congress needs to revive the New Deal programs that worked so well for FDR 80 years ago. I mean, capitalism has always been, always will be, whether it was in Sumeria 7,000 years ago, in Rome 2,000 years ago, or today, it's a cyclical economic system. Boom and bust cycles happen. They're inevitable. And that's why to make stability and security in a country, why government has in the past and needs to today to step in and serve as the employer of last resort like it did in the 1930s. It's time for a new deal. Now, why are the Republicans not only not going to allow us to have a new deal? In other words, this is a variation on what Obama has been saying. He wants to build infrastructure. Why are the Republicans not going to allow that to happen? It's the same reason that the Republicans are not going to allow any kind of stimulus. It's the same reason why they're screaming about austerity. Because they know that that multiplier effect that grows economies also works in reverse. If you cut back on government spending, like Roosevelt did in 37, you put the economy into a recession. And they want it there. Republicans want the economy in a recession. Yesterday, there was a headline, I think it was on TPM. Republicans have tested their 2014 election strategy. And their 2014 election strategy is going to be the economy sucks, vote for Republicans. I'm not making this up. They're blaming the economy on Obama and the Democrats. And they're saying, if you don't want the economy to be so bad, vote for Republicans. When they're the ones who are causing these problems, they're the ones who brought about the crash. They're the ones who are keeping things the way they are. They're the ones who are inflicting all this pain on people, and they are hoping, and in fact, it looks like, you know, according to their internal polling, it looks like it might actually work, that people are so upset and so uninformed that they are going to blame President Obama and the Democrats for this bad economy that Eric Cantor and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell have worked so hard to maintain these last 5 years. So we need a new deal. And we need to wake people up to what the Republicans are up to. But this is just a purely partisan thing that they're doing. I mean, you could argue back, you know, the 1929 to 1932, when Herbert Hoover was not doing a great deal about the Great Crash, that it was ideological, or they just didn't understand economics back then. They don't have that excuse anymore. They know perfectly well what they're doing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And they really believe that this is going to help them win the election in 2014 and in 2016. Welcome back. Nick in Henderson, Nevada. Hey, Nick, you wanted to get back to the pot topic of our first hour.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I just find all the hypocrisies with what's going on in our world just ridiculous anymore. I mean, you brought up gay marriage in Oklahoma earlier in the conversation, and isn't it funny how, you know, they quote the Bible when it comes to, you know, what they want to get done, but, you know, when the Bible says, I've given you all the seed-bearing plants and herbs to use, somehow that's illegal.
Right, to use as medicine. You know? Yep.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, I mean, I know people aren't this dumb, but I really think that they think that we're all this dumb. So, I mean, they've already proven that it causes cancer cells to shrink and causes cancer to go back in recession. And I think that's got a lot to do with why they've had such a tough time legalizing or decriminalizing is because of the pharmaceutical companies. They're going to lose a lot when this happens.
Count on it. Count on it. The painkiller manufacturers.
Totally.
The antidepressant manufacturers, the sleeping pill manufacturers, they're all going to get badly hit by decriminalized pot.
And, you know, honestly, it's what they deserve. I mean,
you know what would be really interesting is a year from now to do an analysis of the use of these prescription drugs in these categories where pot works so well, pain, anxiety, and insomnia in particular. And, I mean, we already know the stuff about glaucoma and things like that. But in those three areas, just in the state of Colorado, just do an analysis of prescribing patterns and see, you know, how much of a hit the pharmaceutical industry has taken at the end of 2014 as a consequence of having decriminalized pot. I think it's going to be fascinating. I think it's going to be.
And they would deserve it, too. I mean, they're basically I speak from experience. I have scoliosis. My spine's all messed up. And I could be on painkillers right now if I wanted to go to a doctor and go down that route. But I've already been down that route. And there's only one route that goes, and it's not a happy place. It's right to
opiate addiction.
Yeah. And, I mean, yeah, I understand why kids go to heroin because they can't afford their street pills anymore. I get that. You know, it's cheaper. But how do they even say, oh, well, heroin's worse than that, because it's the same thing. It literally is the same thing.
Yeah, heroin and Oxycontin are not that different. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who's your drug dealer, your street guy or your pharmacist? You know, like, that's basically the difference. And it's sad, but that's, I mean, they need to figure out something else. And,
well, and what we've done is we've set up a system where, you know, the those who are part of the system, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, the pharmacists, the police, you know, the police industry, you know, that everybody who plays inside the system benefits. And so they have to make people who play outside the system pay, right, by criminalizing things. And, you know, this is just it's just promulgating a corrupt system.
Yeah, I mean, and not to mention, but I've heard that alcohol kills 8 times more teens than all drugs combined. And that's
at
the
least
hard stuff included.
Yeah, at least. No, even deaths from heroin and cocaine are fairly rare. Although deaths from prescription painkillers are, I think, the fastest rising category of accidental overdoses, accidental deaths in the country, and perhaps suicides, who knows. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Nevada. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. You wanted to get back to the pot issue from the previous hour?
Yeah, I just first wanted to say, you know, the child that you talked to at the beginning of your show from the Hunter School seemed really well-balanced and a happy child. You know, it's really a testimonial to what kind of a school it must have been. I was able to help it a little bit financially around the holidays, and I'm glad I did. You know, I just want to throw that in there. Yeah, I just wanted to say that marijuana is a gateway drug. It's a gateway to the White House.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And George W. Bush.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think we are pulling out of what I call the narc ages.
Yeah, yeah. Good pun.
Yeah, it's about time. I mean, this is going to go down, and it's a black time in the history of humanity, and I really think so.
Yeah, I think so, too, and particularly when you look at all the lives that have been destroyed and how racially disproportionate.
Oh, man,
you know, this is a legal holocaust for African Americans. This is incredible.
Really has been.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. It's a great pun. Rotkadam, am I saying that right? In Cedro Willie, Washington?
That's Rotkadam from the chat room.
Uh-huh.
It's on me, I guess.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, I'm on a mission to eradicate the word marijuana from the American lexicon.
I didn't realize that it was the old 1920s Mexican slang word for hemp. Marijuana, you know,
I picked it out of obscurity and used it in his newspapers.
Yeah.
And that's where all the racially charged stuff comes from behind marijuana. We should be using the word cannabis, either recreational, medicinal, or industrial.
Right.
And I also wanted to mention that all the points that the lady made earlier came from a book by Jack Herer called The Emperor Wears No Clothes. It's basically the hemp Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I'd like to paraphrase James Carville and say, it's the hemp, stupid, or the industrial cannabis. That's where the money is going to be. It's going to dwarf whatever recreational cannabis is going to bring into our economy.
Well, they've legalized it in Canada, and they're growing it pretty aggressively up there. And
actually, it's quite limited and very, very regulated. You have,
oh, really?
The equivalent of an FBI background check to grow it. You have to register your field, and then an inspector has to come around. And if it's over a certain minuscule level of THC, they can just destroy your whole crop. So it's a big risk for the farmers. And they're barely growing enough. It's all being bought up by the food industry. It's not even making its way to the industrial level yet.
Right.
So it's going primarily towards, you know, seed oil, towards cosmetic and foods. It's not making
any. I used to buy hemp milk by the case. I love the stuff. It's been a while since I've gotten it. I haven't seen it around here, and since we moved to D.C., we used to get it in Oregon. I think it was from an Oregon company. And I'm guessing that they got the hemp that they made the hemp milk out of from Canada. Although hasn't at least one state legalized the growing of hemp in the United States? Isn't it one of the northern Midwestern states?
I believe Jerry Brown went ahead with it in California, but I'm not sure what kind of limitations they put on it.
Uh-huh.
Or if they're still negotiating with the federal government on
that. Yeah, well, we should track that down. Okay.
That is where the money is.
There you go. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Isaiah in Chicago. Hey, Isaiah, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good.
There are a lot of jobs out there, especially union jobs, that require you to have random drug tests.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a drug test and you fail one because you smoked weed, you know, last week, 2 weeks ago, or early that day before you started work. Isn't that discriminatory in effect?
I think the consideration is, or the problem is, that because marijuana or pot or cannabis or whatever, because it's fat soluble and so it stays in your body, stored in your fat tissue for weeks or months, and therefore can be detected in minuscule amounts in a urine test for quite a while, even if you're not smoking it. I mean, even if you're just in a room where it's being smoked, you will still absorb a small amount, and it will show up.
that they're going to, like, in, for example, in Colorado, in those professions where they do drug test people, they're going to have to figure out a way to either recalibrate these tests or just take that out of the list of things that they test for.
Yeah, they're going to have to be, they're going to have to differentiate between to see if the guy smoked weed during or the before work or doing work.
Yeah.
Not if he smoked weed last night or the week before or a month before, because that's kind of discriminatory to a whole group of people.
Yeah.
That do get randomly drug tested. That's probably millions of people that are going to be affected by this. You know, here in Illinois, medical marijuana is now legal, and I'm sure they're going to see how Colorado and Washington goes. So I'm just trying to get some, because, you know, I have work in a job where, too, they randomly drug test. So I'm just trying to figure out how are they going to, like you say, test to see, you know, differentiate between.
And if somebody in your family has medical marijuana, say your spouse or a kid is going through cancer therapy and they're using medical marijuana to deal with the nausea or something, you know, from chemotherapy, you know, presumably more likely a spouse, but you know, you're testing positive just because you happen to be in the same house with the same air, you know, not because you're getting high. I mean, you know, what are they going to do about that? How long has Illinois had legal medical marijuana?
Well, it just, like, January 1st, I believe.
It just started this year. Just started a couple weeks ago. That's interesting. Isaiah, thanks a lot for the call. I think that we're seeing basically the end of prohibition. It's not going to happen suddenly, or maybe it will. I don't know, at a federal level. But even then, you've got all these state and city laws and things. But it's not going to be like, you know, amending the Constitution like that. But I think it's going to happen within much less than a decade.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we'll see how this all plays out. And also whether the Republicans are ever going to say, okay, you can have your unemployment benefits. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very epiphorically ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good. The New Hampshire House of Representatives. On Wednesday, the lower house of the Granite State Legislature approved by a margin of 170 to 162 a bill to completely legalize marijuana. If signed into law, the bill would allow New Hampshire residents over the age of 21 to possess up to an ounce of marijuana at any time. It would also allow a legal market similar to the one that has been set up in Colorado. The state would also impose a 15% sales tax on all marijuana purchases. The war on drugs has been a colossal and expensive failure. Any marijuana prohibition is just common sense. Unfortunately, New Hampshire's governor, Maggie Hassan, doesn't see it that way. She has said she will veto the marijuana legalization bill if it reaches her desk. The fight for legalization is an uphill one in New Hampshire, but the Granite State House of Representatives has definitely put the state on the right path. The bad. The Oklahoma Highway Patrol. That law enforcement agency is under fire today over allegations that some of its officers brutally attacked a deaf man as part of the traffic stop. Here's a clip from a local news report about the incident.
These are photos of Pearl Pearson, a man who allegedly suffered these injuries to his face at the hands of two OHP troopers during a traffic stop in Oklahoma City, January 3rd. An affidavit says Pearson fled the scene of a minor crash in South Oklahoma City and was eventually pulled over here at the Eastern Avenue exit of eastbound I-40. The affidavit says Pearson resisted Trooper Foster and Trooper Hayes and refused to comply with repeated orders to display his hands. What is not listed in the affidavit is that Pearson is deaf.
What makes this story all the more upsetting is that Pearson's car was clearly marked with stickers saying, "Driver is deaf." There's absolutely no excuse for this sort of police brutality. And the very, very ugly, the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility. Earlier today, the Ohio prison executed death row inmate Dennis McGuire, a convicted rapist, using a new drug cocktail that induces behavior known as air hunger. Air hunger is when someone, quote, experiences immense terror and agony as they strain for breath during the execution. Prison officials use the air hunger drug, a combination of midazolam and hydromorphone, on McGuire because supplies of the usual drug used in executions have run out.
We should do away with the death penalty entirely. But let's be honest, killing anyone in a way that causes them unnecessary suffering and pain is just very, very ugly. That's incredible. Hydromorphone. I thought hydromorphone was the chemical name for heroin. No, hydrocodone is not heroin. I'll have to look it up. But the actual chemical name for heroin is something very similar to that. I mean, they're all derived from opium. So basically, he died from an opiate overdose, and the metrolzam, whatever it is, that sounds like it's a benzodiazepine drug. So basically, it was like, here, have a Valium and an overdose of heroin sort of thing, which doesn't sound like a real pleasant way to go. But I mean, you know, no way to go is a pleasant way to go. But what I don't get is if a state is committed to killing people and they want to do it in a humane way, why don't they use the drugs that they use to put down animals, which are barbiturates? They're the same drugs that are used that you can get prescribed for you if you live in Washington State and you are terminal and you're within 6 months of dying and two doctors certify it. They will prescribe you enough phenobarbital or butabarbital or amobarbital, you know, one of the barbiturates. They'll prescribe you enough of an overdose that you just, you know, drink that thing. And the first thing that happens as the barbiturate hits you is you fall asleep. And then you get deeper and deeper into sleep, and then your body just starts shutting down, and you stop breathing, and you die. And, you know, with your loved ones around you in a rather gentle way. The problem, I think, you know, for doing this in prisons is that it takes 15 or 20 minutes, you know, for that to happen, or maybe an hour or more. And they want to get it over with and done with, and, you know, or maybe it's that they don't want it to be painless. I don't know. Did you find the chemical name for heroin? No, it's not either one. Yeah, I know it's some kind of dihydro something or other. It's an opiate derivative. Dan in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I wanted to mention again, a couple of people have already mentioned about marijuana being a gateway drug, and I think that's just a myth. You know,
well, I like the guy who called and said it's a gateway to the White House. The last three presidents were all pot smokers.
That was pretty good. But I'm in my late 60s, and I have a lot of friends, you know, we've been smoking a long time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And not one of us has ever thought, well, I think I'll go out and get some harder drugs now that I've smoked this. It never was that way, and we all preferred rather have pot around anyways rather than hard drugs. So I think it's just a myth when they try to promote something of that nature.
Yeah. How is that?
I wonder if this... Huh? Go ahead.
Well, finish your thought, please.
Oh, I was wondering if that guy that you spoke to at Heritage Foundation bothered to listen to all these people calling in.
I don't know. The show's available on the web. He certainly can. I don't pick on guests when they're not around to defend themselves. So I'll just leave it at that. I'm curious. You're in Washington State. How's the decriminalization going there? Have they rolled anything out yet, or are they still, you know, fiddling with it?
Seattle, I believe they have some stores over in Seattle, but they don't over on the east side of the state here. The east side of the state is more Republican controlled. In fact, there was a bill a few years ago to divide the state into two different states.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the same thing with Oregon. I mean, you know, it's the east half of the state is right up to Idaho. You're running up against Idaho, aren't you, over there too?
Right. Seattle's Spokane, we're about 10 minutes from Idaho.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
the side of the state.
Yeah, so
yeah,
it's...
And also, as far as the... medical part of it definitely has, you know, good properties for that too. I used to be on Zoloft and Cymbalta just made me feel strange. I just threw it away.
Mm.
And smoking weed helps much more than for depression and anxiety, which I battle with all the time.
Yeah.
So that guy from Christian Heritage, that's what it is, a Christian think tank.
Well, no, it's actually it's not a Christian. I don't think that they're a Christian think tank. I think it's just a conservative, you know, funded by billionaires think tank. I think Joe Coors helps set the thing up, and I think maybe the Koch brothers, I'm not sure. But
I think you're right with Coors. I've heard that before.
Yeah, Joe Coors was one of the founding members. Anyhow, Dan, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your comments. Kathy in Lincolnshire, Illinois. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question on marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, my son, and he was in middle school, was busted last year.
Ouch.
Now, we wanted to understand the ramifications, because we were shocked, actually. And we put him in an intensive therapy, a group therapy session, that was about 12 hours. It was at least 12 hours a week. My son has ADHD, and the first thing I discovered going through this therapy session is that, and I was shocked, that approximately 70 to 80% of the kids in that room had either ADD or ADHD.
Right, and they were probably using pot to self-medicate.
Well, it wasn't just pot, but, you know, they were using some form of substance.
Right. Yeah.
Now, later on, I had two psychiatrists say this to me, and I was unable to determine which way the statistics were applied, but I'm curious if you know more about it, because one of the things that came out is, well, it's either, the statement was either 70% of people with ADD, ADHD use some form of substance to self-medicate,
mm-hmm.
or approximately 70% of substance abusers have ADD or ADHD.
I would guess that both statistics are right.
Right.
I personally don't remember. You know, back in the late 90s when I was writing books on ADHD and I was doing a lot of speaking and I'd go to the conferences. There was one conference that I went to where there was a really crackerjack presentation on the association between ADHD and drug abuse, and both legal and illegal drug abuse. And it was in the context of, you know, should we or should we be giving basically crystal meth. I mean, you know, this is what Adderall is. It's straight meth. You know, it contains three forms of methamphetamine, including pure methamphetamine. That's one of, you know, it's one third of Adderall. And, you know, should we be giving this drug of abuse to children who are at a high risk for drug abuse? And, you know, the consensus was very ambiguous. You know, a lot of people in the room were saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't, maybe we should be rethinking this. And other people were saying, you know, these kids are going to they have much higher potential for drug abuse. And so, you know, let's do it in a therapeutic way. Let's do it in a controlled environment rather than, you know, having them just buy stuff on the street and not even know what they're getting. And I think that you can make a strong case for that, frankly. My theory, and I wrote about this in a book called Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, is that kids and adults, for that matter, with ADHD, have lower levels of a neurochemical that regulates sensory input into the thalamus, and that so they're not as in touch with the sensory world around them, and so they use, you know, they erupt basically to get into that world. Dopamine is the neurochemical that I'm talking about, and these drugs, that most of these stimulant drugs, stimulate dopamine. But anyway, that's Kathy. It's a topic on which there's a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion. There's no easy answer that I know of. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give the gift of a goat or you can buy a heart pendant made by women in South Sudan who have had somebody die and in front of them. And Ellen, you were just telling me these women that you've been working with,
3 years.
Yeah, for 3 years, many of them have family members who are now in this war that's going on in South Sudan.
They're in the civil war. They're seeing their people. And I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, we've been getting these women with post-traumatic stress, working with them for 3 years, and I'm sure their symptoms will come back, because we had a couple of the women, when I did the final assessment of them, their symptoms came back, and I said, well, now this is strange. So, one, I knew they weren't lying to me, but two, I looked at it, and they had family members in Abyei, and so their symptoms came back.
Oh, yeah.
So, here we go.
It just makes sense. Firing the
trigger. Anyway, here we go.
Okay. So, what's going on in the news?
Well, the House passed the Exchange Information Disclosure Act 259 to 154. They are asking that 33 Democrats went to the Republicans on this one or voted with Republicans, and that they're asking for a weekly update on Obamacare. They want HHS to give them an update on exactly what's happening, and they are very specific. HHS says that's an awful lot to be doing weekly and will take them off the task of getting what they need to get.
Are the Republicans willing to fund extra staff people to do this?
Is a 10-pound Robin fat? Of course not.
Okay. All right.
What? Help do a report? Fund it?
Pay for somebody to do something that we're asking them to do?
No, it's never going to happen.
Okay, right.
If it was their administration, they would, but yeah. not to help the president particularly with that. Yeah. And Henry Waxman said it's an effort to slow down implementation of the new law by drowning the Department of Health and Human Services in red tape.
Oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Of course
actually.
It is. Yeah. And then Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania said, well, they're spending money on questionable activities under preventive health care fund. I mean, so it went back and forth.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of our friends, the Republicans, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said that the handling of Benghazi was how New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has handled his scandal. And today, really? From the White House, from the White House, Jay Carney said, strikes me as a little bizarre to compare what's happening in New Jersey to the Benghazi attacks.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can tell you, I've had, on two different occasions, I've brought this up with conservatives that I was debating. Both times it was on the TV show, and, you know, brought up the Chris Christie thing. And their response was Benghazi. At least nobody died. Right. You know, Christie may have screwed up traffic, but four people didn't die like they did in Benghazi under Hillary Clinton. And I'm like, wait a minute.
I take the George Washington Bridge all the time. I wasn't happy to hear about its closure, but I got to tell you, I wouldn't have even thought in my wildest dreams to compare it to Benghazi.
Yeah.
Okay, or to Hillary Clinton, or just crazy. Okay, so apparently, now this is popular culture, there was some e-cigarette smoking between Julia Dreyfus and smoking an e-cigarette at the Golden Globe Awards. Apparently NBC put the camera on her several times. Today, several Republicans, Henry Waxman, Frank Pallone of New Jersey.
Henry Waxman's a Democrat, isn't he?
Yes. I'm sorry. Did I say Republicans? I meant Democrats. Stephen Burke, they wrote to him. He's the CEO of NBC and said, a very long letter about promoting e-cigarette smoking and really, trying to sort of make that sexy and interesting and all that kind of stuff, and asking the networks not to do that.
Well, it's illegal to smoke on TV, on network television. So,
but not an e-cigarette.
Huh. Interesting.
I mean, the law wasn't.
Yeah, the law didn't contemplate the existence of e-cigarettes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's now.
So are they going to amend the law to include?
Well,
or was this just an FCC regulation to begin with?
Well, I think it was an FCC regulation to begin with. I don't think it was actually a law.
Right.
So we would need the FCC to step in. But again, you know, television stations could regulate themselves. It's not asking a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, some other things. There is a bipartisan group today said that they want to bolster voting rights. As you know, the Supreme Court last year gave a crazy ruling on that, on getting rid of voting rights in certain areas. Today, Patrick Leahy Sensenbrenner, who's a junior of Wisconsin, a Republican, and John Conyers said they have a proposal with bipartisan negotiations. And they want there's no details to the bill, but they want to change the rewriting of the formula that says that states don't have to list their changes or get permission to have changes
Under the Voting Rights Act.
Under the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Sensenbrenner occasionally makes a common sense.
Sensenbrenner, right? Yeah. Occasionally, yeah. Common Sensenbrenner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
For a Republican.
For a Republican, that's right. Well, you have to, stop clock is right twice a day.
I know there is that, yeah.
Okay, Dr. Tom, more going on.
Yes.
Obamacare replacement coming. As you know, the Republican Party has said that they want to have a different kind of bill, et cetera. But have you seen a bill come out of the Republican Party on an alternative to President Obama's health care bill? Absolutely not. Nothing for the affordable health care. Well, today, how long afterwards we've seen this bill go into law? Today, John Boehner said that the House Republicans would unveil and possibly vote on a place to a plan to replace the law in 2014. This is the first 2 weeks of 2014.
Presumably, they will do it in the middle of November in 2014,
right,
promising it very aggressively early in November and late in September.
That's
October,
right. Yes, exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Because there's an election coming.
There is an election coming, and they're not stupid.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that is going on. Also, there is, as you know, the Syrian National Coalition. It's more of a moderate rebel group. They're not going to the Geneva II conferences on Syria. We're not quite sure why, but they said that Geneva II is a plot that allows the Americans' sponsors to form the Syrian opposition delegation at their own discretion and according to their own interests. So now they're accusing the good old USA of dealing with that.
Incredible. That's incredible.
Also, a former Republican National Committee chair, Ed Gillespie, is going to run against Senator Warner in Virginia.
And let us not forget, Ed Gillespie started his career as a tobacco lobbyist.
Yes.
Perfect
and
position
he still
for
is a lobbyist.
Yeah. I guess so. Ellen Ratner. Thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. The Journal Sentinel reporting a private school participating in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program abruptly closed in the middle of December, but not before collecting more than $200,000 from taxpayers this academic year. Life Skills Academy, a K-8 school, had, by the way, only one student who was proficient in reading. Closed in the dead of night. They moved out, as people say, in the dead of nights, Father Carl Dietrichs of All Saints said. And they list the school's leader as Taryn Monroe and her husband, Rodney. They got $633,000 in voucher payments last year and $202,000 this year, collected more than $2 million in total public payments, and they vanished. And then they popped up down in Florida, living in a gated community on the waterfront, and they've apparently opened a new private school down in Florida. I find this very, very strange. And then we look at some of these studies here. Western Michigan University's Evaluation Center found that charter schools in Michigan, quote, posted significantly lower scores and less consistent gains on state standardized tests. A study in Ohio found, quote, falling short of traditional public schools in the majority of comparable performance measures, concluding the charter schools were doing no better than low-performing traditional public schools with similar demographic characteristics. Study in North Carolina, quote, charter schools were lagging behind traditional public schools in achievement growth. 2010 study commissioned by the federal government and Mathematica found that students who won lotteries to attend 36 charter middle schools across the country performed on average no better in math and reading than their peers. So why would anybody support these voucherized schools that Eric Cantor is telling, he's basically threatening the new mayor of New York. He says, if you don't do more of these private for-profit schools so our buddies can make a buck, we're going to have congressional hearings. Bob Bowden is on the line. He's the executive director of ChoiceMedia.tv, a school reform advocate pro-school choice, charter schools, vouchers, merit pay, and other types of education reform. Choicemedia.tv is the website. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Tom. Good to be here.
Why would you, you know, unless you're making a buck off this, why would you advocate a system where in order to educate kids, you have to also be skimming some money off the top for profit?
Well, I think what you've done is cited a few anecdotes that are rare and said and suggested that that kind of represents the school choice movement generally, and I think that's not the case. And part of the evidence that's not the case is that millions of parents, more and more every year, keep lining up for these school options because in so many instances, the regular public district schools are worse than the worst nightmare stories that you have to cite for the school choice effort.
I have some familiarity with this. I started a private school, my wife and I, back in 1978, and we're on the board of it. In fact, we had one of the kids who was a student in that school on the air today on this show. And I've been on the board of that program for over 30 years. But it's a non-profit organization. I take no money from it. We have no stockholders. Nobody makes a buck off it. Every dollar that goes to them, if it's a donation, it goes right to, you know, whatever they're doing. And if it's tuition, it goes right to the school services. And the people who work there are, I can guarantee you, they're not getting rich. We got no $100,000 salary kind of things going on here. I look at some of these private schools. We have some friends out in California who are running private schools in Southern California, and they're making $250,000 a year. I mean, as individuals, as the head of the school. This boggles my mind.
There certainly can be elite private schools that charge whatever they want, and I don't think that even most in the traditional American left would be against that and would be telling Barack Obama you have to send your kid to a public school.
I'm not saying that there should not be private schools and there should not be boarding schools like George W. Bush went to. What is that, Andover Academy or whatever? I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that I shouldn't have to pay for it.
Right. So I think usually when you cite those kinds of super high salaries, as you've done, it's an example not of publicly funded schools. It's usually examples of elite private academies. But look, I could go all day long also talking to you about, say, Sally Jo Widmer, an upstate New York teachers union president that stole over $800,000 in money. You could call it public money. You could call it union money.
Is she in jail?
Pardon?
Is she in jail?
She died. They learned about this after her death. In fact,
okay, but she would have gone to jail, right?
Who knows? She seemed to keep it hidden.
Well, if she embezzled money from the school, she would have gone to jail. But the people who are running your for-profit schools and are putting hundreds of thousands of dollars in their pockets, they're not going to jail.
No, she.
But they're asking. They want to put their hand in my pocket and take more of my money to pay for for your schools.
No. There's a difference between stealing money, right, and making money, you know, legally. That's a distinction. But I'm just saying.
Well, that's why I think this should be illegal.
Either side, and you've given just the anecdotes of basically the sort of the school choice movement. We have all kinds of examples in Los Angeles, a school that was built for a single high school cost $500 million that was built in 2010 at the site of the former Ambassador Hotel where RFK was assassinated. That site in Los Angeles. Basically, contractors left and right walked away with money shoved in their pockets because of the traditional public school system where it's a monopoly environment, and generally the thesis there is spending in and of itself is good. The more we spend, the better it is. It's kind of an inputs way to assess public education and how we should allocate resources. And there are a lot of people who just believe the more money thrown at this, the better.
Isn't the solution for that, though, local school boards? You know, if you don't like the way that money is being spent on schools in your school district, join the school board. Run for the school board. I mean, the public schools are publicly supervised. They're answerable to the voters. Private schools are answerable to stockholders who are saying, how much money did you make for me this week off those children?
If you were right, then there wouldn't be mostly black and Hispanic parents lining up in inner cities for choices in like charter schools and like vouchers in the states that have them. These are low-income parents.
But what they're finding in wait a minute, you're mixing apples and oranges. You've got people who are lining up for public charter schools that are not for profit.
Both.
That are run, but the private charter schools, they do not have that the kind of track record that the public charter schools do, and the for-profit charter schools have the worst of those track records.
first of all, that's not true. Let me.
It certainly is in New York State, New York City.
Well, first of all, most of the charter schools in the country are nonprofits. There's only about 10 to.
Right, they're run by school districts, so you guys can't even claim them.
No. Many are not run by the school district. Many are run by nonprofit charter school operators.
But
so that's the first thing. Something like 90% are nonprofits. So we're talking about a minority. Secondly, even in places where there are more for-profit charters, like the state of Michigan, for example, where about 80% are for-profit, studies there have shown that they've done actually better than the nonprofit charter schools. The bottom line is parents generally don't ask the first question of, well, what is the tax status of the school that my kid might get into? Well, that's what I'm really focused on. What they're interested in is the school, does the school have a good reputation? Do the teachers care? Do they work hard? Those kinds of issues are what parents are evaluating, and that's why you have long waiting lists. The parents want in those schools.
Would you not acknowledge that education should not be a for-profit business, that we shouldn't be making a buck off educating our kids?
The fact is, I think it's a canard to suggest that traditional public schools don't make a buck. Are the people who work there working there for free? Are what about the contractors?
They're not living on dividends. You don't have capitalists running those private schools. You have workers, people who are, by the way, as I said earlier, answerable to the local community.
Well, the point is that everyone involved in the system, the supplier of textbooks, desks, gym equipment for the recess area, the building, people who build the buildings, as well as the staff who runs the school, the janitors, the teachers, they're all paid money for their participation, okay?
Yeah, but this
the bottom line is if you're right and these privates, the private tiny portion of charters that are for profit, if they were terrible, there'd be no parents picking those schools.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Why are they doing that if these schools, if they're so resource-starved to shove the money in their own pockets and line their pockets that they're draining so many resources out of the school?
Bob, you got the last word.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bob Bowden, choicemedia.tv is the website. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jack in Wakanda. Oh, Jack, you're listening to WCPT, and they're in a commercial break. Hang on just a minute. Let me pick up a Free Speech TV caller here. David in Ferndale, Washington. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Jack, or David. Hey, what's up?
Yeah, I'm 55 years old. I've smoked and ingested cannabis for well over 50 years, and I have information on it. Pardon me?
Since you were 4 years old?
No, I'm 77.
Oh, okay.
And I smoked for about 50 years when I first went in the military.
Okay.
Lived in California for a number of years. I'm diagnosed with severe degenerative bone disease. I've had both my knees replaced, and it's the only thing that doesn't debilitate me to a point where I'm non-functional that relieves pain. One thing about your fact person on cannabis, I don't know if you're familiar with Mayor LaGuardia, but he was called the Little Flower because he was, at the time, one of the few government officials who commissioned a scientific study on the effects of cannabis and had totally favorable results and, as a result, was nicknamed the Little Flower.
Yeah, the LaGuardia study is actually fairly famous. I mean, you know, in pot
Yes, indeed. Now, my doctor will not prescribe cannabis because he's afraid of his medical license. He's from Canada and has dual citizenship, but the feds have threatened him if he prescribes cannabis to any of his patients. My brother in New York State desperately needs that kind of help and can't get it because it's not available. In Washington right now, you're going to pay in stores $50 an eighth for marijuana. I can buy it on the streets for $250 to $300 an ounce. They're still trying to figure it out here in Washington.
Right.
It's also the same price in Colorado, $50 an eighth.
An eighth of an ounce.
Yes, yeah, which is about $400 an ounce, and that's pretty high.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if it's totally legal and an ounce of fairly high potency pot represents, you know, a month's worth, I mean, that's what people pay for a decent bottle of wine.
Absolutely. And in the old days, cannabis wasn't as strong as it is now, but they're making it out to be a lot more than it was. And you could find something like a Thai stick or whatever that was of equal or acapulco.
Oh, sure, hash.
Yes, close to equal potency. And I also have a Class C felony conviction against me for possession of cannabis because I couldn't find a doctor to prescribe it.
Oh, that's...
I'm trying to find out now whether there's something I can do about it now that it's not only legal medically but recreationally here in Washington State. And another comment, I have friends in California who are growers, and they can't give away their cannabis there because the price has just fallen out of the bottom out of the market. There's
because the supply has exceeded the demand?
Yeah, apparently.
Huh. Amazing.
So it's having Northern California has some of the strongest cannabis on earth in the great climate, and it does well there. But these guys who have been there, and there have been incursions of the drug cartels from Mexico and all that, but it's not profitable for them to do it right now.
Yeah. Well, that market will work itself out. You know, I mean, that's what's going to happen all over the country. And that's one of the benefits of regulating it is that it will cause the marketplace to work itself out in a way that people can make a living at it and thus not create a black market. Although I like the idea that they have in Colorado, if you can grow six plants yourself. I mean, that's like a continuous supply. David, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Jack, listening to WCPT in Wakanda, Illinois. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I've been listening, and I thought to your comments about the Republican strategy to keep the economies in want is perfectly online, and I thought you ought to use their own words against them. And that dates back to a 2011 Republican study committee that justified the layoffs of the post-2010 layoffs of public employees as saying that highly paid public employees entering the job market would flush the job market, pushing wages down and thus making America competitive again. Their strategy to make America competitive is that you and I need to make less.
Whoa. How do I find that document?
It's a Republican study committee, and I'm not in front of it right now, but it came out in 2011, in the fall of 2011.
Thank you.
And that was essentially the quote. I've been mulling this quote over for, you know, the year and a half and citing it when I can. And I thought you would like it to get your hands on that.
Yeah.
I'll do some research, try to get a copy of it myself, but I read it back in 2011 and I've read it subsequently, but I don't have immediate hands on
it. I'm going to try and track it down.
Justification for the
I mean, every now and then you get these little gems. It's like, you know, I included this one in my book Screwed, where Alan Greenspan told the Wall Street Journal that his most important job at the Fed in the years that he was chairman of the Fed was to maintain a certain minimum necessary level of worker insecurity. Right. In other words, always keep unemployment high enough that workers are not demanding wage increases to stop what's called wage inflation. And so he, you know, whenever the economy would start to heat up, he would raise interest rates and slow the economy down to maintain that certain minimum necessary level of worker insecurity. And I thought, wow.
Well,
I mean,
it's just secure. They keep you untethered, don't they?
That's right. It tells you the whole thing. Jack, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And, you know, I will be using the DuckDuckGo machine when I get off the air. I'm on it. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up? Steve, you are on the air. Steve is not there. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad you brought up the execution today in Ohio?
Yeah, that was pretty grim.
It's beyond grim. I caught on the local news report at noon some of the aspects of the execution. One, it was the longest one apparently recorded in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they talked about that the man clenched his fists. He also mouthed, "I love you," several times to a couple of his family members that were witnessing the incident.
took him like 15 minutes to die, didn't it?
Right, something like that. No one will say for sure, of course, because they're worried about what their words might mean, that this was cruel and unusual. But the broader point is, when you put it in perspective, clearly, by any rational standard, it appears this man suffered.
Yeah.
Combine that with, let's cut off food stamps. That's suffering. let's cut unemployment benefits for people that are long-term unemployed. This is suffering. Now, at the worst of the worst, if you are condemned to death, whether you deserve it or not, that's a whole other issue, you will suffer. What this creates further is an atmosphere of fear. It's fear. And I don't think this is much different from what Ellen Ratner was talking about during her segment.
Well, with the PTSD,
women
with the women
suffering PTSD.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say it's I wouldn't use fear as the word. I would say it creates an atmosphere, an authoritarian atmosphere, an atmosphere. You know, it coarsens us. I mean, when society kills people, it does something to society. We had a yesterday, or maybe it was the day before yesterday. You know, one of the fellows who's just watching the show, some guy just watching the show, called and was talking about the down at Guantanamo. I was talking about how the Republicans won't let these 77 guys who have never committed any crime at all. They were not terrorists. They were not criminals. They just got swept up and dumped in Guantanamo. And this one guy's on a hunger strike, and he's trying to die. But they've been cleared for release by the Bush administration 6 years ago. But Congress every year passes a law, the Republicans in Congress, saying that the Bush administration cannot use any federal money to transport anybody in or out of Guantanamo, out of Guantanamo anyway. So these 77 guys are stuck there. And this one guy, he's a British citizen. He wants to go home to his family. His wife was pregnant when he was captured. He's never met his youngest child, who's like, 8 or 9 years old now. And this guy called up and he said, It's destroying the guards, too. And I think he said he had been a soldier, and he started crying on the air. And you just get it that it is so dehumanizing to our society. Can you imagine the guy who had to put the needle in that guy's arm and kill him? And the people.
Right. Well, look at it in a bigger picture. I mean, it's when I say an atmosphere of fear.
Mm-hmm.
People that can be incarcerated without charges.
Well, and just our entire penal system is brutal. I mean, the shoe, this solitary confinement.
Whether or not you could be incarcerated, we're being spied upon. If you fall between the cracks, you will be punished. If you are punished, you will also face suffering on top of it. It's brutal and incomprehensible.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Our society in the last, there's always been an element of coarseness in American society. I mean, we started out with the genocide of the Native Americans and slavery of African Americans, but it seems like it's, in many ways we've gotten better over the years, and in some ways we're backsliding right now, and have been for the last, since 9/11 basically. I think 9/11 just it brought out the fear in the fearful and the powerful people who were fearful. The Dick Cheneys and the George Bushes of the world have been using that fear and promoting that fear, particularly in the right-wing Fox's sphere, constantly for political benefit and in many cases for monetary benefit. Michelle, thank you. Very, very trenchant observation. We will be back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yes, indeed. We must maintain a certain necessary minimum level of worker insecurity, Mr. Greenspan. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, back with you. And heroin is diacetylmorphine. I don't know why we had that conversation back an hour or so ago, but thank you, Sue, for that in the chat room. And, yeah, dihydromorphone. Oh, that's Dilaudid. Yeah, okay, got it. Oh, I know why. It was because some guy who was experiencing a lot of pain called in and said that pot was helping him relieve his pain, and he had been on, yeah. Oh, this was the drug. Hydromorphone was the drug they killed the guy in Ohio with. Aha, okay. Yeah. And that's a just a very, 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 very powerful narcotic. So anyway. Steve in Hampshire, Illinois. Hey Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You're the man. Hey, just in response to the guy who was talking about why all the people are flocking to the low-income communities, schools, charter schools, well, one, a couple of reasons. One is the tax base there is so low that the schools are operating at a deficit anyway. Mm-hmm. And any time you have vouchers pulled out of that system, it's going to further make it worse for those schools to try to get by. So right. Those guys, or the parents, are just trying to get their kids somewhere where they think they're going to have enough resources to educate them. That's
right. It's creating a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. So they're just talking, you know, where about their, you know what. So
yeah, I know. It's basically A, they hate teachers' unions or all unions, and B, hey, we can make a buck off something off the commons. How much fun is that?
Good for them. Oh yeah. All right. Thanks, Tom. You're the man.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. Great to hear from you. And Richard in Evanston, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Well, he just made my point that the inner city schools, Hispanics and blacks being the predominant people, this is where these school districts have caved in to the charters. And my daughter teaches in one, and they're just, this fellow's a true believer, and everything that charters do is perfect, and it's nonsense. He's never been in one, or he hasn't been in every one of them.
Yeah.
And they're just true believers, and they're not open to.
I don't think it's so much they're true believers as they're true, you know, I was going to say hustlers, but that's a little harsh.
Yeah.
But they're true entrepreneurs, capitalists. You know, they see an opportunity for profit, and they're going to and you know, legislators opened that door. And I'm pretty sure back, you know, 30 years ago when we started the school in New Hampshire, that it wasn't even an option to start a for-profit organization of that type, although it was never our intent. So I don't recall really. But anyhow, back to you.
I think the door was opened at least in Chicagoland because the Catholic schools are the religious schools.
Right, but they're not for-profit organizations. Those are still not-for-profit organizations. And see, a not-for-profit corporation has to demonstrate to the IRS that they're principally doing what they're chartered to do, whereas a for-profit corporation has to prove to its stockholders not necessarily that they're producing a good product or providing a good service, but that they're making money. And those are very different value systems.
Yeah. Well, I think that was the door that opened. That was the push that opened the door on the charters, as I recall it. But I'm not sure. Can I jump to Guantanamo for a real quick second?
Sure.
You know, this seems like everybody wants to get rid of Guantanamo. You know, the president said it, and the Congress is getting in the way. So they created these impediments. But as the commander in chief, couldn't he just say to our forces that he's, because he commands them, pull everybody out? You know, we're not going to close it. Just I want all the guards coming home. I mean, if you get messed with enough by these Republicans, at a certain point, maybe the rules should change. And politically, you know, maybe the people would really, the populace would kind of agree, because it would highlight this obstruction. I mean, to keep people 12 years who aren't guilty of anything. America just has closed its eyes to it, you know, and like the wars. I mean, you know, so maybe at a certain point, you know, enough is enough. And I think I would tend myself.
That's a very interesting proposal. That would require a president who was willing to basically take names and kick ass in a very, very big way. You know, that's political chicken at a very high level. And I don't think that President Obama has ever played that way. But I think it would work. I think if he were to say, you know, we're just going to, you know, there's a gate between Guantanamo and the rest of Cuba, and Fidel Castro has a fine little country here, and he can decide what to do with these folks. We're going to open the gate, and we're going to bring all our soldiers home.
You know, it's risky. I just, as I say, I mean, maybe it's unwise. I'm sure he's a much smarter person than me. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. Richard, thank you for the call. Pierre in Hartzell, Colorado. Hey, Pierre, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to throw in a few more facts about the THC thing.
Okay, on pot.
For you and your dead father. But Louis Armstrong smoked pot until he died, and he died at like age 84 or something like that.
Yeah.
The other thing is that...
and Willie Nelson still is, you know.
Yeah, I know. And Nixon basically made it a Schedule 1 drug so that he didn't have to hear about it anymore. And that's why it got looped in with heroin and all of those things. And picking up people for pot became equitable for the police. So there was that, and it's never been changed. Two, the studies. No one ever does studies because Reagan really didn't want the studies done after they kept coming back that they couldn't find any really real detriment to it. So they basically quit funding those studies. But on NOVA, they had a show one time called The Botany of Desire, and it was about the four plants that have changed the world. And marijuana happened to be one of them. And on that particular show, I was just shocked. But basically, they showed that we have a receptor in our brain.
We do.
That is the same receptor in THC.
That's great.
And this was all found out like in 1964, an Israeli biochemist basically did studies. And then again in 88, he did some more studies to show exactly what all this was about. And then in 92, they found out while they were exploring the brain that the THC worked in these receptors that they had never known anything about. And when these receptors, when they started studying the receptors, it was made up of the same chemicals exactly as THC.
Right. In other words, we co-evolved with this plant.
Yes, we did. And there is a reason for it. And so the other thing is that there's another Jack Harris book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, is excellent. But there's been an updated thing and by a filmmaker called Massimo Mazzucco, and he did a film called The True History of Marijuana. And I have a friend who's a neurologist that she insisted upon me seeing this film. And in it, it goes through all the various things, the history, et cetera, and now all the new information that they do have. Now, here's something really ironic, though. In Colorado, which now we have, you know, legal marijuana, if you had a marijuana card for the dispensaries for medical marijuana, you were not allowed to have a gun. Now, don't you think the NRA should have been all bent out of shape about that? I knew guys that were so bent out of shape about Colorado and doing the gun thing and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But they smoked pot. And I said, well, you got your medical marijuana card? Oh, no, you can't. If you have a medical marijuana card, you can't have a gun.
Yeah.
And don't you find this really ironic?
Yeah, I do. I find it very strange. And frankly, you know, somebody who's smoking pot is much more likely to be looking for the brownies and the Coca-Cola or whatever, you know, sugary sweet drink, you know, fill in the name, than they are a gun. amazing. Pierre, thank you for more factoids and for the call. I appreciate it. Edmund in Hot Springs National Park. Hey, Edmund.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I have two quick questions from you. First of all, I noticed that you always use the words unconscionable and shameless. And I was wondering why these people are so shameless and so lack of empathy and compassion. The reason is when they get elected, they know that the average citizen is like a catalyst. I know you're educated. You know what catalyst is.
Mm-hmm.
Something that gets in a chemical reaction but doesn't get involved in a reaction.
Right.
So these people know once they get elected, they basically are corporate stooges and they do everything for money. And I always feel that we put so much emphasis on Republicans only. I'm from a red state. I have I used to have a congressman and the senators and my current Democratic senator. They do nothing that sounds Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And so only thing that I think that we should put emphasis on it is to change our campaign law and put on a sound and fundamental system that we take the money out of this equation so money doesn't...
I absolutely agree with you, Edmund. The problem is that the Supreme Court says you can't do that. You can't pass a law like that because according to the Supreme Court, money is protected by the First Amendment because it's the same thing as speech, and the First Amendment explicitly protects political speech.
So this is why I say go to movetoamend.org. We need to amend the Constitution to say, no, sorry, the Supreme Court is wrong. Money is money. It's not speech. It's property. It's stuff. It's you know, whatever. It's that paper in your pocket. It's those numbers in your checking account. It is not speech. But Edmund, I absolutely agree with you. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's fascinating. There's charter schools, the death penalty, there's in New Hampshire. I mean, there's so many interesting things going on. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Larry in Nutley, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
I had two quick points about the charter school issue.
Mm-hmm.
That guy was recycling an argument from Milton Friedman. Basically, Milton Friedman said that if the market is a democracy, because if you want a red tie, buy a red tie and they'll make red ties. If you want a blue tie, they'll make blue ties.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, what you can say is, well, if what the market chooses is always better, why are people buying so much bottled water when they can get better tap water for free?
Right. Well, are you asking that rhetorically, or do you have an answer to it?
Well, the answer to that is advertising.
Yeah.
And PR.
It's creating demand.
The same reason why people drink soda instead of milk.
Right.
You know, milk is better for them, but soda has better advertising.
Or it's the same reason why people drink milk when there are some people who would say milk is actually bad for you, that milk is designed for baby cows, not people.
All right. The other point about that is I work in higher education, and so I've been following congressional investigations of for-profit colleges. And they've been ripping off not only their students but also federal taxpayers, because they essentially they promise all these great jobs after you graduate, but they don't give you the training that you really need for those. They give you really substandard training. And then when the poor people who've taken out loans to go to those private colleges like Berkeley, Gervais, graduate, they don't get a job, and they wind up defaulting on their loans, which are backed up by the taxpayers.
You're right. My recollection is that private for-profit colleges represent 10% of college enrollments in the United States, roughly 50% of all college loan defaults, and that on average 90% of their students drop out before they achieve a degree, although I might be wrong on that last. There was a 90% in there. I remember the 10, 50, and 90. I'm pretty good at remembering numbers.
Nonetheless, people sign up for them and people pay money.
Yeah, because they advertise.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm of the opinion that education, you know, I remember a time when I was a kid.
When I was a youngin' back in Michigan in the 60s,
you could not run a health insurance company or a hospital on a for-profit basis. It was illegal. And healthcare was inexpensive and widely available. And I believe you could not run a school on a for-profit basis. And I think that we need to return to those values, to those standards, to say that there are some things, you know, the education of our children, the quality of our healthcare, that should not have a dollar sign attached to them. They should, you know, people should go into this because they love it. Well, I mean, we need to pay people well who are doing it. But you know, if a community is going to start a school, they should do it because they need a school, not because somebody has decided that they can make a profit off it. Am I making sense here, Larry?
Certainly.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WBAI. I do appreciate it. It's this is the whole thing. I mean, you know, charter schools. Here's the great deception. Most charter schools are not-for-profit schools that were started by local school districts. And, you know, they do okay. Many of them do pretty much the same as the other schools. So the for-profit guys come in and they say, well, I'm going to start a charter school. And everybody thinks it's the same thing. It's not. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before you go. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. George in Keyport, New Jersey, listening on WBAI out of New York City. Hey, George, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just want to thank you in advance for educating me and everybody else that listens to your program.
I was reading my local newspaper Lunchtime, and they had an article about the budget bill that Congress passed. And they listed in the article how the social programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are a drain on the budget. Well, I'm going home tonight, and I'm going to fire off an email to the editor telling them it's not the social programs that are the problem. It's the tax breaks that the wealthy are getting. It's the free ride that the corporations are getting. And I'm going to quote you directly and say they should go back and repeal the Bush tax cuts and go back to the Reagan area tax standards.
Yeah, well, I think they should repeal the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, you know, we had prosperity and stability in the United States and a strong middle class from the 1950s until the 1980s, and then Reagan came in and dropped the top tax rate. And Larry Beinhart's done some great research on this. Whenever the top tax rate is above 50%, then, you know, people will, for any income over $3 million a year, people will earn their first million or $2 million or $3 million, and then they stop, and they keep the money in the business, and the businesses grow, and the economy is relatively stable, and you don't have these explosions of people making $2 billion in a year kind of thing, you know. And then when you drop that top tax rate, then people start saying, hey, you know, I think I'll take a lot of money out of the company. The companies start to suffer, the middle class suffers, and then this is like hot money. I mean, it was easily gotten money, and so they start gambling with it, and then you get these bubbles in the marketplace, and you get stock markets that go boom and bust. And it's, you can just absolutely track it through the history of taxation over the last century in the United States and Europe and other countries as well. And, you know, God bless Larry Beinhart for doing that research. George, thank you. Was there another point you wanted to make?
No, that was it. I'm definitely going home tonight and send that letter to the editor.
Okay, good on you. Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening to WBAI. David, listening to KGOE in Eureka, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I actually wanted to kind of correct you on your influence or contact high from being around smoke.
Yeah.
Now, I'm retired military, and, you know, I smoked before I joined the Navy. And then when I did, I stopped for 20 years, you know, mm-hmm. No big deal. So those people that say that it's addictive or that it's a
right,
you know, platform drug to other ones is, you know, got a moot argument.
I've never met anybody who's a pot addict, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, while I was in, I was part of the your analysis program, and you know, you go through a whole lot of training, and they talk about minimum levels that you have to meet in order to, you know, trip a positive on a drug test. And they do that because there's all kinds of natural elements that can flag a false positive, so they set that minimum level so the THC actually trips the level so that they can bust somebody for it.
Right.
Now, they did testing with that. One of the stories that they tell in those classes is one of the tests they basically did was let a bunch of officers drive around in a car in Washington, D.C. with marijuana going in this vehicle. And they tested them before and they tested them after and found that there was no significant increase in the THC level in their blood system. Now, I can.
I'd be very skeptical. That,
I can. No. Now, here's the part that makes me believe that. During my entire 20 years, I've been exposed to marijuana smoke. Mm. You know, on a daily basis at some points. So, and I've never ever. You know, I've taken
never tested positive.
Urinalysis test.
Okay, so you're saying that these urinalysis tests are the threshold is set high enough that somebody who's getting basically passive smoke and not enough to get high is not going to trip the test. That's good to know. I mean, that's actually
exactly good
information.
And they've set it up that way.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
And I'm sure that in Colorado and Washington, they're going to try, I would imagine, if, you know, they want to do this legally or, you know, to protect the citizenry, they'll find that level and limit at which somebody becomes impaired or, you know,
well, they're going to have to
fall off of.
Yeah, they're going to have to because you don't want somebody driving who's really, really, really stoned. I mean, you know, it's you just don't. Just like you don't want somebody driving who's really, really, really drunk. And although I think that the equivalence between the two is not a one-to-one equivalence by any means. But excellent information. David, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to KGOE. Dwayne in Petaluma, California, watching on the web at TomHartman.com. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Tom, I want to talk to you about the Bacchus Hatch Camp proposal to revive the fast track for the TPP.
Yes, sir.
And things I wanted to point out is that Congress doesn't have the authority to fast track. There's nowhere in the Constitution that that was granted. They have this constitutional authority to pass laws and to for the Senate to pass treaties with two-thirds vote. But there's nowhere does the word agreement appear, and this whole process is unconstitutional.
I agree. These are treaties. They are not agreements, number one. And number two, the House and Senate can change their rules. And
yes.
But I don't think you change your rules by legislative action. This bill was a bill. It was not a proposed rule change, unless I'm missing something here.
Right. And what I want to point out, though, is, and I would disagree with you in your comment about it being a treaty. NAFTA was not a treaty. It didn't get the two-thirds vote required to pass a treaty.
No, but I think it was a treaty because, you know, the Constitution defines treaty as things that involve trade between us and other nations.
But it never passed then because it didn't get the two-thirds vote.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's totally unconstitutional.
But I wanted to point out that basically the rights that they're transferring to this organization, that is to unelected group, a tribunal,
right,
to decide upon our laws, it amounts to the usurpation of the rights that we granted the Constitution to Congress.
I agree.
It amounts to the subjecting us to jurisdictions foreign to our Constitution.
Right, which the founders would have called tyranny or treason. And I absolutely agree with you, Duane, and I think it's absolutely terrible what Max Baucus and company are doing, and they need to be called out. You need to be contacting your members of Congress and saying, no, we don't want this fast-track thing. Stop it and stop it now. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday, so of course, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, America's Senator, will be here taking your calls on the important issues of the week, plus Anything Goes Friday. We can talk about pretty much anything you want. All the news and information you won't hear from the corporate-owned news media are right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.